Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, sexual harassment has been in the news recently because of allegations about GOP presidential hopeful Herman Cain. But what does the way media discuss sexual harassment tell us about how we view women, especially in the workplace? We'll talk to Julie Barabitsky, professor at Sewanee, the University of the South. Also on Counterspin today, the corporate media message on schools and so-called education reform is consistent. More testing, more charter schools, and more pressure to weed out underperforming teachers. But what happens when facts get in the way of this narrative? We'll talk to Cambridge College professor and Schools Matter blogger Jim Horn about some recent news that challenges the corporate reform script. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
The crackdown on the Occupy Wall Street camp, along with crackdowns at others around the country, coincided with an uptick in media coverage portraying the protests as violent, unsanitary threats to public safety. The November 16th Washington Post sounded more like Fox News Channel when it posed this question in a news article, quote, "Is this an occupation or an infestation?" Close quote. Meanwhile, the political leader responsible for the crackdown, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, was given an odd description by the New York Times. In a piece about his action against the camp, Bloomberg was referred to as a, quote, champion of the First Amendment, close quote. It's not clear what one would have to do to be designated as such, but those who can remember back to the 2004 Republican National Convention might recall that New York engaged in massive spying on and infiltration of protest groups, mass arrests of peaceful protesters, and some preventative detention of protesters who were trying to exercise their First Amendment rights. The city has been forced to pay out millions of dollars in legal settlements and continues to resist efforts to release files relating to the police department's suppression of speech. Given Michael Bloomberg's record on stop and frisk arrests, perhaps the Times will call him a Fourth Amendment champion, too.
Whenever you read financial news, you have to keep in mind the audience such news is geared towards. Good news in Europe drives stocks higher, was the headline of a closely read Los Angeles Times financial blog, Money & Company, on November 11th. The Associated Press was touting the same good news for several days running in mid-November under the byline of reporter Pamela Sampson. So what was this good news? Italy and Greece were moving closer to implementing austerity measures. As the LA Times blog put it, quote, "Each sign of progress in Europe sparks powerful rallies in the market, but bad news stirs equally abrupt sell-offs," close quote. Countless business news stories more accurately report that austerity is good for markets and bond traders. But even these reports present an imbalance, as there are rarely corresponding stories reporting that the measures are highly unpopular and will inflict hardship on the people who live under them. So the good news is that there will be more pain for Greek and Italian citizens, as austerity measures will force even more job losses and cuts in social programs and pensions. The bad news? That's when democracy threatens to derail such unpopular policies. But they're policies that bankers say are necessary, and why should we doubt them?
When is a massive tax cut actually a tax hike? That's a good question to ask about recent reporting on the Congressional Supercommittee that is supposed to come up with a debt reduction plan any day now. Media usually talk about the standoff here between Republicans who won't agree to raise taxes and Democrats who won't agree to cut Social Security and Medicare. That's not exactly accurate, but we're constantly told that both sides have to give up something, which is probably why reporters were buzzing about a Republican offer of a tax increase. As the Washington Post reported, quote, "Congressional Republicans have for the first time retreated from their hardline stance against new taxes, offering to raise federal tax collections by nearly $300 billion over the next decade as part of a plan to tame the national debt," close quote. References to that $300 billion tax hike were soon everywhere, but anyone who checked the Republican offer saw that it came with a giant catch. The plan would extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, and then some, bringing tax rates down even further for those in the top tax bracket. So suddenly a plan to raise tax revenues by $300 billion is actually more like a plan to cut taxes, mostly for the well-off, by a far greater amount. Those facts sometimes made it into stories about these negotiations, but they're given far less prominence than the headlines about the Republicans' bold compromise on taxes.
The New York Times style section had a profile of ABC military correspondent Martha Raddatz that started out badly and then got worse. The bad start was the reference to war reporting as being a glamour beat, before noting that, quote, glamour is probably not an adjective at the forefront of Ms. Raddatz's viewers' minds, close quote. She's old, you see, but also manages to be, as the Times puts it, remarkably put together. Then the article gets worse. The Times explains that Raddatz is a different kind of reporter. Quote, her approach to the beat is to cover war in its entirety, close quote. What they mean is that she's quite close to U.S. troops in the field and also their families back home. She is a reporter who shows the human side of war, explains the Times. That depends on which humans you're talking about. When there was criticism of drone strikes in Afghanistan that were killing civilians, Raddatz was on ABC World News to declare the strikes must go on and that she'd seen the care coalition forces take in carrying them out. Raddatz herself tells the Times that, quote, no matter how you feel about this war or how we got into it, you have to care about our servicemen. I can't pretend to be objective when it comes to service or sacrifice, close quote. That attitude seems evident in her work. The strangest part is the Times takes all this and somehow manages to point out this, quote, despite her worldview, Ms. Raddatz is very much a denizen of the Beltway culture, close quote. Actually, it's hard to figure out what in Raddatz's worldview would make her stand apart from Beltway elites.
And finally, if you were wondering how anti-immigrant bias can find its way into science reporting, the San Jose Mercury News provided the answer on October 26 with a story that began like this, quote, like any new immigrant, the deadly West Nile virus became American almost immediately after landing on our shores, altering itself to fit in, and then infecting a popular backyard bird to secure a firm foothold in its new home, close quote. The story is actually about new research from a local biologist, but Mercury reporter Lise Krieger's editors would have to be oblivious not to see how the lead draws an analogy between a deadly disease and human immigrants, and further deepens that analogy by seeming to suggest the virus is employing a sort of anchor baby strategy to secure a foothold in its new home. The Mercury News story earned a well-deserved mention in the Columbia Journalism Review's When Leads Go Wrong feature on November 1st. If the editors of a California newspaper are unaware that racist and anti-immigrant groups routinely claim immigrants bring diseases and compare immigration to pestilence and epidemics, we'd like to know where they've been living.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. Allegations that GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain may have sexually harassed women, and perhaps worse, when he headed the National Restaurant Association in the 1990s, have prompted a lot of media discussion of sexual harassment. Opinions have ranged from the totally dismissive — talk show host Rush Limbaugh and National Review writer John Derbyshire say there's no such thing — to the merely diminishing. Anti-feminist Katie Royfe argued in a recent New York Times op-ed that the discussion largely boiled down to whether or not telling a dirty joke in the office is a crime, to the serious. A piece by syndicated columnist Connie Schultz discussed her own past experience with sexual harassment in the workplace. Our guest's November 9th column in the Philadelphia Inquirer, Burden Still Falls on the Victim, was a serious piece, too. Julie Barabitsky is a professor of history and women's studies at Sewanee, the University of the South, in Tennessee, and the author of the forthcoming Sex in the Office, A History of Gender, Power, and Desire. Welcome to Counterspin, Julie Barabitsky.
Thank you very much.
You write that a review of the current discussion of sexual harassment shows that, quote, our understanding of women and of sex in the workplace remains startlingly antiquated, close quote. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. So certainly there have been tremendous changes in the laws, and certainly everyone agrees that quid pro quo sexual harassment is wrong. But when we turn to something less than outright extortion, we still seem to hold many of the same views about gender that were around more than a century ago when women first entered the labor force in large numbers. First, there's a real distrust of women. They're either vindictive, or they're gold diggers, or they're overly sensitive, or they can't take a joke. And at the same time, many people also seem to give men the benefit of the doubt. He was just joking around, or he was just expressing his interest. And certainly there's also a sort of a subtext of this that any man certainly wouldn't pursue a woman once she said she wasn't interested. A number of the comments that I read, especially of readers who were commenting on other pieces, said a firm no is all it takes, or maybe a slap. And even if a man does come on too strong, he certainly won't pursue her once she says she's uninterested.
These antiquated views are about how we think of women, and you say we don't trust women. Where does that come from?
I think that it comes from the fact that we still see women as temptresses, and we believe that men in some ways are really the vulnerable ones, that a man might be a woman's boss, but really he's a sexual creature, and too many women are willing to sort of play on that vulnerability. Back in the 19th century, there was certainly concern that women might be taken advantage of, but there was even greater concern that a sort of designing woman would use her sexual power over men to get a better wage or to get a day off. And this is at a point when women really are very limited in their employment opportunities. Today, we see this in a sort of new focus on enticement. There's a lot of people who say that women's enticement of men is the corollary to sexual harassment. So there's this notion that certainly men have power, but women have sexual power too, and in some cases, that's a greater type of power.
You know, critics of sexual harassment laws often say that the laws are Victorian in their views of sexuality, but you're sort of saying the opposite.
Yes. Back in the 19th century, certainly some reformers acknowledged that working women experienced potential sexual danger. But the women themselves, the working women, actually always denied that they received behaviors that we would now think of as sexual harassment. And the reason they did that was that any time they said, yes, you're right, we experience sexual extortion, we experience insults, instantly after they said that, the attention shifted from the men to, well, wait a minute, did you do something to bring that on? And why didn't you quit? If a man was doing that, any honorable woman, any lady would have run out the door. So women were in a position where if they said anything about behaviors that they were receiving, that they brought suspicion on themselves. And so I think that sexual harassment laws try to provide women with a way of saying, hey, look, let's look at this and what's really happening. Let's take this extortion or this behavior that makes my work life a sort of living hell. Let's take it seriously and investigate it.
Well, you know, this is related to that, but one of the commentators you singled out in your column is New York Times columnist David Brooks, who suggested that perhaps a stigma should attach to women who take settlements but don't speak out. Explain for us what's wrong with that way of thinking.
Well, first of all, I think there's a real problem with settlements, and the Cain situation has definitely highlighted for us how often that occurs. So beginning in the 1990s, we start to see more companies require employees to sign contracts that say they will resolve any employment dispute through arbitration and through confidential settlements. And what that does is it certainly hides the sort of reality of sexual harassment. It's sort of no longer public. We can't talk about it because it's confidential. And David Brooks suggested that it was a way that women could certainly get away with something possibly, right? That they knew that they could get a settlement, and he believed that women should go public. In some cases, women can't go public because their employer demands that they sign a contract that says they'll settle disputes out of court. But also, we need to acknowledge that a woman who goes public is going to sort of be tarred and feathered. One of the things that I think is so sad about the Cain situation is that even though two women received settlements from the National Restaurant Association, everybody still said, oh, well, that's, you know, it's probably all made up. She knew that she could get a settlement because it's cheaper for somebody just to pay her off than to go to court. This restaurant association made two settlements, and we still don't believe these women, and the women that have come forward have been sort of brutalized. Who's going to come forward anymore? So David Brooks, I think, was not acknowledging how a woman going public really endangers her career.
Pieces like Katie Royfe's in the New York Times suggest that sexual harassment is often about small things like a one-time off-color joke. Is that really what you've found in research of the history of sexual harassment?
Statements like that are really why I wrote my piece, that sexual harassment is certainly not about jokes. It's not about compliments that a woman didn't want. If you look at the EEOC definition, it says very clearly that the law doesn't prohibit simple teasing or offhand comments or offhand comments or isolated incidents. And it also makes clear that it has to be behavior that's unwelcome. What I found during my research was that already from the end of the 19th century, one of the most common things that women experienced, this is back in a point when the primary office job for women was as a stenographer, was that their employer would dictate sexually explicit material to them that had nothing to do with work. And the woman had one of two options. She could throw down her steno pad and quit, or if she needed her job, she could just sit there and listen to it. Imagine where your livelihood depends on subjecting yourself to that behavior. Your boss does it simply because he knows he can, because he wants to, because he's got that power. Another situation that happened to more than one woman, walks into her boss's office, he pulls down his pants. In one case, a woman said, "Please pull them up," and he looked at her and said, "Why should this bother you? You're from the gutter." The stories that I encountered were just bizarre, just strange sort of stories. The one I talk about in my article involved a woman whose coworker kept pursuing her. She repeatedly told him no, and she came back from lunch one day to find a bottle covered in Vaseline with dead flowers in it. That sort of stunned me, right? What does it even mean? But when you think about it, it's clearly a sexual threat, or it's certainly not unreasonable for that woman to have interpreted that as a sexual threat of possibly rape. So sometimes when we heard the joke about Herman Cain and his wife's height, we think this is just, or when we heard with Clarence Thomas the pubic hair on the Coke, we think this is just too bizarre to be true. But the stories I found were always bizarre, but they were repeated over and over again. The story I said about dictating something sexually explicit, I have evidence of that in the 1860s, in 1900, in World War II. So these behaviors are not just compliments or jokes. They are serious invasions into a woman's ability to do her job well.
We've been speaking with Julie Barabitsky, a professor at the University of the South and the author of the forthcoming book, Sex in the Office, A History of Gender, Power, and Desire. You can read her recent column about sexual harassment at philly.com. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Julie Barabitsky.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
If you follow corporate media coverage of what's called education reform, it's usually pretty easy to tell which side they're on. A handful of deep-pocketed foundations and think tanks have set an agenda that stresses testing, charter schools, and a supposedly data-driven approach to evaluating teachers. Over the past few years, there's been more pushback against this agenda, but it's hard to change the media narrative on public schools. The nation's educational system is in crisis, and a crew of superhero billionaires and take-no-prisoners administrators will shake up the unions and turn things around. So what happens when reality intervenes and tells a very different story? We're joined now by Cambridge College professor Jim Horn, who's also a blogger at Schools Matter, to talk about some recent developments that don't fit in with the dominant corporate reform narrative. Jim Horn, welcome to Counterspin.
No, thank you very much for having me.
I want to talk first about some good news, in a way. There was a really strong report in the New York Times by Michael Winterup about this new teacher evaluation scheme in Tennessee. The state wins a Race to the Top grant. Part of the deal is they've got to come up with some kind of elaborate mechanism to evaluate teachers, mostly using student test scores. The system, by the reporter's account, is a mess. Most teachers don't have students that are scored, so they're judged based on other scores. You've got math teachers that are being judged on English scores and on and on. The piece was really a standout. 5 days later, the paper weighs in with an editorial about Tennessee schools and teacher evaluation that may as well have been written on a different planet. Tell us what struck you about that editorial in the New York Times.
Well, what struck me essentially is it represents a sort of a consistent pattern of the editorial board at the New York Times, which one would probably argue they don't read their best reporters' news stories. But it follows the narrative that the editorial board has established in terms of supporting the corporate education reform movement. So it really wasn't a surprise. It was more or less the confirmation of their previous positions.
They sort of had to reinforce the status quo. When they're talking about Tennessee performance, student performance, though, what jumps out from the numbers that makes the editorial seem so disconnected?
Well, the first thing that the editorial did was to use National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP scores, to point out how Tennessee was failing, which is the standard narrative to use test scores to point out school failure. And, of course, in pointing out that Tennessee's performance is somewhere between 42nd and 45th in the nation in terms of the most recent NAEP scores, what the editorial doesn't do is to point out some other interesting figures that sort of help to understand how Tennessee got there. The per-pupil spending in Tennessee ranks 44th in the nation, a little over $6,000 per student per year. And not only that, Tennessee ranks 45th or 46th, depending on how you look at it, in terms of the number of students living in poverty. So those two numbers, the poverty numbers and the per-pupil spending numbers, are very consistent with where Tennessee stands as far as NAEP scores nationally.
And the Times message, and I guess a lot of the corporate media coverage, is to mostly ignore those things and to say, if only they had better teachers in those same schools, things would be so fundamentally different. That does seem to be an emerging theme in the kind of corporate reform narrative.
Yes, it's a consistent demonization of schools, and now more specifically the demonization of teachers. And to say that if we could just get rid of the bad teachers and bring in some good teachers, then we could solve the problem, which essentially discounts entirely the whole issue, which is the issue of poverty. Because where we have high poverty levels, we have low test scores. This is consistent, almost a one-to-one correlation, and any standardized test you use, whether it's in third grade or whether it's the SAT or...
Now, another thing we talk about, teacher bashing, another thing that's popular among corporate reformers has always been charter schools. There is this belief, it's not unrelated, that if you can show that there are these mostly union-free schools that attract superb teachers and turn around students in struggling communities, you'll have a kind of model that can be replicated everywhere schools are failing. Now, the studies of charter school performance have never been able to live up to that hype. This is, again, where reality sort of intervenes. You wrote about a new study funded by interests very close to the charter movement that came out very recently. You haven't read much in the media about it. They haven't even done a lot of publicity about this new charter school study. Why?
Well, it doesn't fit the corporate narrative because the same thing happened in 2009 when first nationally peer-reviewed charter study came out, which showed that charter schools were scoring better than matched public schools only in 17% of the cases. In 37% of the cases, they were scoring worse than matched public schools, and in 46%, there was no difference. So this study, done by Mathematica, and principally by Mathematica, found that the picture is not so advantageous in terms of promoting charter schools because despite the advantages that charter schools have, and the advantages including fewer English language learner students, English language learning students than public schools, fewer special needs students, the fact that the study found that charters in this study had smaller classes, that they on average have more money, particularly for those chains like KIPP and Uncommon Schools, and that they have children who are almost entirely black and Hispanic who have higher achievement prior to coming to the charter schools than the public schools. So even with these numbers of advantages that the charters have, the study found that there was, on average, no statistically significant difference in performance between the charters and the public schools. Some were higher, some were lower, but the differences on average were no statistically different than the public schools.
You noted that it didn't get a lot of attention. The attention that it got was somewhat positive. You do have to think, and maybe this is a bit cynical, but that if there was finally a charter school study that delivered the results that the charter school proponents promise charter schools can deliver, we're going to read about that one on the front page of the New York Times and other papers. Do you think that's probably the case?
Well, actually, that has been done. There was a study by Dr. Hoxby of New York Charter Schools following the Stanford study that was released in 2009. And her study found that New York charters were doing a great job, but the study was not peer-reviewed, and after that, a number of scholars did review Dr. Hoxby's numbers and found that her procedures were, shall we say, not up to snuff in terms of presenting data in a credible way.
And yet I remember watching her on ABC with John Stossel, so I guess
Yes. Well, that's, you know, that's John Stossel, right?
Well, we've been speaking with Jim Horn. He's an associate professor of educational leadership at Cambridge College, and you can read much of his work at the website Schools Matter. That's schoolsmatter.info. Jim Horn, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Peter.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. Again, that's 1-800-847-3993. Or you can go to FAIR's website at www.fair.org for more information. That's also where you can listen to Counterspin and subscribe to the Counterspin podcast. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.